State Attorney General Lisa Madigan has launched a criminal investigation into the way Governor Rauner and his administration handled the Legionnaire outbreaks at the Quincy Veterans Home. Last Thursday, he apologized publicly for the first time.
To the families here tonight and the families across Illinois who lost loved ones, I am sorry for your loss. It is deeply painful. And I pledge to you that we will continue to do everything we can to keep our veterans safe.
Also, Judy Valente is a longtime reporter from the Bloomington area, and her latest book is about the rule of St. Benedict and how it changed the way she thought about happiness.
And somebody gave me this book, and I opened the rule of St. Benedict and thought, what the heck is this?
And there's a new photography exhibit at the American Indian Center in Chicago called Standing Rock, Photos of an Indigenous Movement. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, a conversation with Bloomington writer Judy Valente about how wisdom from the 6th century can apply today, and a new photography exhibit in Chicago documents the protests at Standing Rock. But first, last week, during a gubernatorial debate in Quincy, Governor Rauner made his first apology to the families who lost loved ones to Legionnaires' disease at the Quincy Veterans Home. This was the final governor's debate last Thursday night, and while the Republican candidate still defended his administration's response to the multi-year outbreak, he did offer this.
To the families here tonight and the families across Illinois who lost loved ones, I am sorry for your loss. It is deeply painful. And I pledge to you that we will continue to do everything we can to keep our veterans safe.
12 families are suing the state for neglect over the deaths of their family members. In addition, State Attorney General Lisa Madigan is pursuing a criminal investigation into whether Governor Rauner and his administration violated any laws in the way it responded to the outbreak. WBEZ has been following this story for almost a year, and we're joined now by reporters Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold. Hi, guys. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla.
Dave, the debate began by questioning Governor Rauner's handling of the outbreak. We played just a little bit of that. What else did the governor say?
Well, I mean, you captured it there in terms of Quincy. I mean, he started right out of the gate to show, you know, I think sort of an emotional side that we haven't seen up until this point. And, you know, I think as the way that Tony and I reported, and I think others did, that, you know, we characterized it as an apology. And I think there was some blowback to that because, like, you know, is an apology showing, you know, contrition for what went wrong and that mistakes were made, or is it just I'm sorry for your loss kind of thing? And that I think is what some of the families reacted afterwards, I think, in a way that was, you know, many of them did not accept that. They, you know, there was one that tweeted out afterwards, too little, too late. So I think with them, it sort of fell on deaf ears. But I think, you know, strategically and politically for the governor, it was his effort to try to do his best to put this whole issue behind him.
You all did talk to some of the families. You gathered some of them, I know. Dave, I wonder if you can tell us about the meeting and what they shared with you.
We thought it would be interesting to bring these families that have been part of our reporting for almost a year together. It's interesting that many of them come from Quincy, but they don't know one another. And we were, as reporters, very curious to see how, you know, if you put them all in the same room together, how would they relate? And, you know, I think it was sort of, in some ways, part kind of group therapy session and part, you know, venting session, because these people, you know, they all shared the same story that they basically felt powerless as their loved ones were getting sick, and that they felt as if the state wasn't telling them what was going on or acting quickly enough and arming them with the information they needed to decide whether they wanted to take their loved ones out of the home or not. And, you know, for Steve French, you know, one of the things he said, you know, it was his first time back in Quincy after having to deal with all that. And, you know, he made a deliberate attempt in, you know, getting to the place where we all met to steer clear of driving by the home itself, because it was just too much of an emotional thing for him.
Let's actually hear from Steve French. That's one of the family members that Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney spoke with.
I struggled with coming to Quincy. I haven't been here since it all happened, and so I had to give it a lot of thought. But now that I'm here, I'm glad I came. The thing that I can't get, I just can't get my head around, is how the administration sticks to that story.
Yes.
That they haven't done anything wrong.
Right.
That they would do it again. I don't understand, knowing that there were people that could have been saved, they wouldn't do something different.
That's Steve French speaking to Tony Arnold from WBEZ. He's on the line with us, as well as Dave McKinney. Tony, can we, as there's so much to unpack there, but can you just start with the beginning of telling us about Steve French and his mother? Because you really can hear how obviously hard it must be for these people who lost their family members.
Yeah, you can hear the emotion in Steve's voice there, and it wasn't unique to him. And when we gathered the families together here, there were five total members of five families total there. It was emotional for everybody. But for Steve's case, both of his parents were living at the Quincy Veterans Home. His father needed more help, and so he was in one part of the campus there at the Veterans Home. His mom was living in independent living, and she was healthy other than the fact that she was deaf. And what he kind of relayed to us again when we met up with him before this debate was that he had been out with his mom just a few days before she ended up being found. And in her case, it was a situation where he found out about Legionnaires through the news. He just heard that his brother heard a news report said that there's been Legionnaires found at the veterans home. He called over there to check on his mom. Steve says that he was told that she was okay. And then it turns out the next day that her body was found in her room, and the coroner ruled that she'd been dead for some time.
And Tony, remind us, this is a Legionella. If you contract this is something that is treatable, correct?
It is treatable with antibiotics. This is a bacteria that lives in the water. Somebody who's infected through antibiotics or through any number of methods of boiling water or filters or that kind of thing.
And had these family members met before, Dave? Had you guys had some of them, I know, live in Quincy, right?
Well, yeah, that was one of the striking things about it all. It was a first time for many of them to come together, and it was a time for them to kind of vent about, their belief that people had not been held accountable for the mistakes that were made in the aftermath of these Legionnaires' outbreaks. And it was also just a time to sort of share what each of them went through. And again, it was a very emotional thing.
And one thing that stood out also was how much they all said their stories were all so similar. Separately, they didn't know each other, but together they all felt like what happened to their parents at that veterans home through the outbreak in 2015, they all shared very similar experiences and what the home did not tell them and what happened to their parents.
Also, Tony, I mean, their lawsuits had pretty much sat in obscurity, really, for a year and a half before we sort of stumbled upon them. And these folks were all kind of in their own separate silos, thinking they were taking on the big state of Illinois by
themselves. Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that, now they understand that it's not just their family and their family alone doing it, I think that kind of empowers some of them to be more forceful. And, one of the people that was there was from the family of Eugene Miller, who passed away there. And the son of Mr. Miller, one of the sons anyway, Tim Miller, when we first started talking to Tim back in the spring, I mean, he and his brother were very reticent to talk to us. They didn't want to do anything that would imperil their case against the state. I think they were wary about the politics that would emerge, and they just wanted to kind of steer clear of all that. And what's interesting with Tim Miller is that, he's really become engaged politically. I mean, to the point where, he cut a commercial for J.B. Pritzker, who has, kind of picked up and used this issue, tried to use it against Rauner. But Miller has described himself as a Trump voter. I think his family has been, as many of those families that we spoke with, I think they have been traditional Republican families. And Adams County, where Quincy is at, is sort of bedrock Republican. So, it's just interesting kind of seeing how they've all evolved, really, from, this point when they lose somebody, they decide to sue the state, they think they're by themselves, and then they all sort of find their voices.
To that point, I wanted to play another, as you're talking about the families being more forceful. Here's Diane McHatton, another family member.
Do they think we're all stupid? I mean, here they are not telling us for 6 days, and our family members are in there. We could have had a choice, people.
Yeah.
We could have took our fathers and mothers out. We could have got them other help, and they had the audacity not to tell us for 6 days, some of us longer.
That's Diane McHatton, one of the family members who lost a loved one in the Quincy Veterans Home. We've been talking about this story with WBEZ's Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold, who have been reporting on this for almost a year. Tony, as we now know, recently, within the past few weeks, there's been an investigation launched by the state attorney general. What is Lisa Madigan looking to find out?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. Her office has not said when they began the investigation or what they're looking into, other than we know that the investigation could include criminal or even civil statute violations. This is something that her office has been tight-lipped about. They've not shown their cards, but they do have to work with the Adams County prosecutor if they want to, you know, pursue anything through the grand jury there. And that would be the Adams County prosecutor told us that the grand jury would next be meeting on October 25th. We'll see if there is something presented to them from the attorney general. I suppose in theory, Lisa Madigan's office could bring something to the grand jury. They could also not. We just don't know yet.
Dave, you and Tony have been investigating how the governor's office acted, especially in terms of notifying the public. Maybe you can share what you guys have learned about that.
Well, I mean, from almost the very beginning of this, we knew that there were issues with the notification system that they had there. I mean, it seemed very apparent from early on that the state was caught flat-footed in how to approach this, at least from the standpoint of alerting people. You know, I think, you know, Rauner has continually pointed to the fact that, you know, once they had a couple of cases that were confirmed Legionnaires, they embarked on a whole series of moves internally at the home, you know, shutting off fountains, watching patients more carefully and the like. But what they didn't do was inform the public. And what we found in December of last year was an email from the state public health director where he was justifying waiting 6 days before notifying the public about the outbreak at the home. And within that 6-day period, there were, I believe, at least 4 people who began showing symptoms of their Legionnaires, and they would go on to die. One of those people, the French family in particular, is heavily impacted by that 6-day darkness, I guess you could say, because Steve French, whom we heard from, he had gone the weekend prior to his mother being found. He had gone to the home to visit her. She seemed like she was in great health. They went out to eat. They went shopping. And then, the next thing he knows, the following Thursday, he hears from his brother in Waukegan that there was something on the radio about a Legionnaires outbreak at Quincy. And so he immediately calls the home on that Thursday to ask about his parents' well-being. And he's told that if they haven't heard anything, then presume everything is okay. And then, you know, by the time the weekend rolls around, he gets a phone call and says, is it okay if we go into your mother's room? And they found her. But in his case, as you can see, I mean, he was dependent entirely on the state saying something publicly about this. And, you know, he's told us repeatedly, had he known that there had been confirmed cases, which were confirmed before his visit there, you know, to visit his mom, he could have pulled his parents out of there and found other accommodations for them. And they might, you know, they might well be living today. So, I mean, that's part of the big issue. But, you know, over time, what Tony and I have documented with these notification problems is that there were outbreaks in 2016, again in 2017, more cases in 2018. What we found, particularly in 2016 and 2017, was that there were weeks and in some cases months before the state acknowledged Legionnaires' cases at the home. And what's problematic about that is that you would think that that facility and the Rauner administration in particular would be acutely aware of the importance of notifying the public anytime Legionnaires reemerged there, particularly when they, you know, had when the state had spent millions of dollars, I think $6 or $7 million, to upgrade the water system at the home, ostensibly to make it safe. And yet they kept having these outbreaks. And, you know, at some point it kind of begins to take on the appearance that they are slow walking bad news to the public, because it's sort of a difficult thing to explain publicly, if, you know, if
why
you're
it took so long to
why
notify
it took
people.
So long.
Why? And I should, yeah, I should note to our audience, we also, we have reached out to Governor Rauner's office to invite him to join us to talk about this. We did not get a response. As we're just wrapping up here and as we're thinking about, we started this conversation by the fact that this was a debate between Governor Rauner and J.B. Pritzker, where Governor Rauner offered a response saying that this loss was painful and sorry for it. I wonder how much you think this hangs over the election, Tony?
You know, we talked earlier about how J.B. Pritzker is running TV ads here in the closing weeks, making his closing argument to voters through the way that he's communicated more than almost any others to voters of Illinois, which is through TV ads. And this ad with a family member talking directly to the camera, you know, saying, talking about his own father and the personal story. There's a part of that that I think is resonates. And so clearly, Pritzker believes this is a compelling story that would move voters in his direction. So to that extent, this is clearly a large campaign issue. It also just, you know, speaks to, I think, governance and how that's gone, the fact that it's kept coming up throughout Rauner's term.
Certainly, this is a problem that has been multi-year, as you all have shown with your reporting. That's WBEZ reporter Tony Arnold. I want to thank Dave McKinney, his colleague. We will tweet out their links for this coverage that they have done of Legionnaires and the Quincy Veterans Home. We also spoke, and the debate as well. We also spoke, by the way, to the director from the Department of Public Health, Nirav Shah, about this months ago about this issue. We'll have that link to the conversation at our website, 21stshow.org, and we will tweet that out as well. Tony, Dave, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Nala.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Michelle Regenvetter from the Department of Psychology. Behavioral Decision Research meets Supercomputing, Wednesday, October 24th at noon at the Levis Faculty Center. More information is available at cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. How can wisdom from a 6th century saint apply to America in 2018? That's the question that motivates my next guest, Judy Valente. You might recognize her name. She's a longtime reporter. Most recently, she's been with our partner station, WGLT in Bloomington Normal. And her latest book is called How to Live, What the Rule of St. Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. I spoke with her earlier this year at our Urbana studios, and I started by asking her what the process of writing this book has taught her about listening.
Well, the first question I often get from people is, why should we care about something that was written in the 6th century? Well, St. Benedict, who is the founder of Western monasticism, lived in a time very similar to our own. It was a time when the wealth was concentrated among the few. People had lost faith in their political leaders and in traditional institutions. Great culture was under threat from outside forces. Sounds a lot like the nightly news today, but it was really Rome in the 6th century. And what he wanted to do was not so much flee from the world as to create a different kind of culture, a different kind of community, one that placed community over competition, consensus over conflict, simplicity over consumption, and quietude over the constant distractions that people have in their lives. And this became the monastic community, which remains with us today.
How did you first encounter this community?
Well, very interesting story. Someone handed me the Rule of St. Benedict, in the late 90s, early 2000s. I was transitioning back to the United States from living in London and working for the Wall Street Journal and wondering what did I want to do with the rest of my one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver calls it. And somebody gave me this book, and I opened the Rule of St. Benedict and thought, what the heck is this? And what happened after that was, after my first book came out, which was a book about touching the sacred through poetry, I gave a presentation at a Benedictine monastery in Atchison, Kansas, called Mount St. Scholastica, a women's monastery. And there I encountered for the first time how the Rule of St. Benedict is lived. First of all, I was impressed with the ease with which these sisters moved through their days, the kind of peaceful hearts that they exhibited, and the warmth of that community.
And how long they lived.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, one of my favorite sisters died last year at 101, and she was not the oldest in the community. So you know that this life has something there. And I knew that kind of peacefulness that they had, I wanted more of in my own life. And I realized that everything that they do, from how they eat dinner to the times that they pray to the way that they interact in each other, is based on the Rule of St. Benedict.
And now you're an oblate?
Yes.
What's that?
You're right. An oblate is a lay associate of a monastery. What we do is we try to live the Benedictine values in our day-to-day lives. We may be married or single. We may be widowed. We may be Catholic or not Catholic. That's very interesting. Many, many non-Catholics are Benedictine oblates. But we try to live the values, what we call the Benedictine values, which would be community, consensus, simplicity, and a very important word in the Rule of St. Benedict, which I hope you'll ask me about, which is listening, because it's something that I don't think we're doing very much of in our culture and in our political discourse.
Well, and to that point about listening, you write in the book that you talk for a living. Your job, like mine, is to talk to people. Why do you think that we don't think about the fact that our job is really to listen to other people?
Well, our job is mainly to listen. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a place too much into a corner here in America where we're talking at and over each other and we're not listening to each other. Interestingly enough, the first word in the Rule of St. Benedict is not pray or worship or even love. It's listen. And St. Benedict asks us to take it a step further. He asks us to listen with the ear of the heart, which I think is a beautiful phrase. And that's something that I'm pretty concerned about right now in our culture, and which I need to do more and more of in my own life. More listening, less talking.
My guest is Judy Valente, and we're talking about her new book. It's called How to Live, What the Rule of St. Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. And to that point about listening, I wonder if I can ask you about what he said about listening with an ear of the heart. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it means that each person that comes into our lives brings something, whether we recognize it or not. For example, the idea of hospitality goes hand in hand in the Benedictine world, in the monastic world, with listening. And it's this idea that everyone that you encounter has some gift, which may at first appear hidden to you. And I think this is very relevant as we look at the whole discussion we're having about immigration and refugees in our country. This is a misconception that monasteries were a place that walled themselves off from the rest of the world. That's not completely true. The doors of the monasteries then and now remain open to guests. And there was always a position in the monastery called the porter. And the porter's job was to greet guests, and he was to say one of two things, either thanks be to God or your blessing please, whenever anyone knocked on the door. And I think those are such interesting greetings because they both say that you're expecting good from this encounter with the guest. And we've almost turned that around in our country today. We've almost act like anyone who wants to come here, who hasn't been here for 100 years, is somehow a threat. And that's completely contrary to the monastic value of hospitality and listening and caring for the other.
I think about how people are pretty angry these days. And there's a chapter where you write about the two different types of anger that we often have. And I wondered if I could ask you about that.
I think there is two different kinds of anger. And one is the anger that comes when we see an injustice. And you might call that a righteous anger. I know I feel that quite a bit as a journalist, you know, when I do stories about wage theft, for example, or our African-American and Hispanic citizens being pulled over at higher rates than our white citizens by the police. There are things that create righteous anger. There's a different kind of anger that occurs when our ego is wounded. And I'm guilty of that, too. But a lot of that type of anger is due to the fact that you somehow feel disrespected or dismissed. And that anger has to be looked at and examined through the lens of humility. And a lot of people confuse humility with humiliation. The humility in a monastic sense comes from the root word humus, which simply means of the earth, that we are all of this earth. We are all in this together. Humiliation is something totally different. That's a negative thing. There's an interesting concept that comes through in the Rule of St. Benedict where he's very willing to accept that people are going to mess up. Even people living in a monastery are going to mess up. What's important to St. Benedict is that we examine our faults, we fess up to our faults, we try to make amends, and that we're still lovable and worthy despite our faults. And I found that aspect of the rule to be quite revolutionary for him to be writing this in the 500s, because it relates to what we're seeing now in the justice system. We call it restorative justice, where you, instead of focusing on punishing juveniles, for example, in juvenile court, you try to get them to reform their ways, to make amends. St. Benedict talked about that in the 6th century.
Some of these things are being implemented today. They do seem very countercultural. The idea of humility, the idea of not judging other people. And there's something that you write about in the book where one of the nuns that you encounter, she says within their community, they can disagree and not see each other as a threat. Do you think you have to have community in order to do that?
One line in the rule that's really interesting where he says, be the first to show respect to the other, supporting with the greatest patience one another's weaknesses of body and behavior. We were talking about countercultural. That is the most like countercultural line to me in the whole rule, and the one that's the most necessary for what we're going through today in our public discourse. If you take anything away from monastic life, all the values away, you still have to keep community. That's the core of it. And what's really interesting is the way that they make decisions by consensus. And it gets to what you were saying about not thinking of the person you disagree with as a never-ending threat. And this is a model I think we can use in business and we could use in our families. Everybody gets the same information in a monastery. Every person from the most junior member of the community to the most senior gets to weigh in. And then they see where is the will of the community going. They look at that. And the people who were in the minority at that point have to say, well, what is it that I'm not seeing? And the people in the majority at that point say, well, how is it that we can reconcile what the minority view is? And then the leadership makes a decision. But here's what's so interesting and what I think we need so much in our society. Once the decision is made, everybody pulls in the same direction. Everybody agrees to try to make it work. Now, I'm a journalist. You're a journalist. We've covered so much on the Affordable Care Act, health care reform. Think about what would have happened in this country if we'd spent as much time trying to improve the act as we did trying to tear it apart. It's that kind of a thing where people in a community understand that the community is what's important and you have to move forward and work together.
I'm speaking with Judy Valenti about her book. And Judy, you spent quite a bit of time, you write about your experiences at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. How did you first visit there?
Oh, I love the Abbey of Gethsemane outside of Louisville. It's a Trappist monastery. The Trappists are a form of Benedictine spirituality. They practice a stricter form. I went there for the 40th death anniversary of Thomas Merton. So the first time was 10 years ago. We're now going to celebrate in December the 50th death anniversary of Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk who wrote The Seven-Story Mountain and introduced a lot of lay people to the contemplative life. His idea was you don't have to live in a monastery to live a mindful and contemplative life. I happen to agree with that. And one of the main things you get when you go to this monastery, you walk through an arch into the monastic grounds, and it says God alone, and silence is observed here. And the most important thing I got from my visits there was the importance of silence. We talked about how we talk for a living, but we also listen for a living. But silence is important. In the rule, Benedict says, even good words can be left unsaid at times out of esteem for silence. And when you look at it, words often get us into trouble. You know, especially if you're, you know, somebody with a quick temper, words can get you into a lot of trouble. And I learned at the monastery a very useful thing. Before you open your mouth to speak, ask yourself three questions. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it kind? And is it necessary? And I think that last one is the most interesting one. Is it necessary? Because there's so much talking that goes on that is utterly useless in our culture.
And when you say that, I wonder what you learned about silence, how you implement that now that you, when you're not in a monastery. Because I bet there are a lot of people who are listening who are thinking, that seems like a lot easier thing to do, to be in community and to build consensus and to have time for silence when you're living in a monastery.
It certainly is easier because the monastic day is broken up so that you have periods for study, periods for prayer, periods for rest. And that's harder to do when you live a really hectic life as a journalist, for example. But I think you have to be very intentional about it and build these pauses into your day. I always tell people you can pause and still be productive. I have a friend who sets her cell phone to go off, you know, every couple of hours. And in fact, she has a ringtone that sounds a lot like bells at a monastery. And that is her moment to pause. And why is this important? Because we need to let the mind reboot during our day. I was working for the Wall Street Journal in London for a few years, and I realized that I would come to work in the morning, and I had a lovely desk that overlooked St. Paul's Cathedral. And I would come to work in the morning, and then all of a sudden I would look up at some point during the day, and it would be dark outside. The day had passed, and I'd missed it. I was missing out on my own life. And, you know, I realized that I had to take pauses during my day. I had to take time out.
And now you take email Sabbaths?
Oh, that's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up. I really think it's important to take social media Sabbaths, cell phone Sabbaths, and email Sabbaths. I mean, I really think there's got to be some hours in your day in this, you know, 24/7 world that we're in. You have to have some hours where it's absolutely cut off. You know, I used to have my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal who would miss their kids' birthday parties and, you know, miss anniversaries and things. And you can't get those things back. So you've got to take pauses in your life.
And what have you learned from that silence and those pauses?
Well, you have to live with yourself. Silence really makes you accompany yourself in your journey on life. When you don't have the distractions of cell phone and email and social media, who's there but you and, you know, those of us who believe would say the divine. And it's often in those moments of silence that I have to come face to face with the things in my own life that I need to confront, things that I need to change in my own life. And I also sometimes get inspirations. All of a sudden, an answer that I've been struggling with. You know, I've been talking to my friends or my husband or other trusted mentors about. All of a sudden, in that silence, the answer comes.
That's a little bit of what Judy Valenti learned from St. Benedict. And her book is called How to Live, What the Rule of St. Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. Judy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Blue and White Ceramics, an Enduring Global Obsession, with a gallery conversation October 25th at 5:30 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 2016 and throughout the beginning of 2017, thousands gathered in North Dakota to protest the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Many people from the Standing Rock Indian Reservation consider the pipeline a threat to clean water and to their sacred land. Led by Native communities, the camps by the pipeline site grew to thousands and became a center for resistance and cultural preservation. Michigan photographer Levi Rickert was one of those thousands, and now his photos are part of a new Chicago exhibit at the American Indian Center. It's called Standing Rock, Photos of an Indigenous Movement. It opens tomorrow and will be on display until November 9th, and Levi Rickert joins us now. He's also the publisher and editor of Native News Online. Hi, Levi. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be back.
Levi, when we think about it, the protests weren't that long ago, even though I imagine for many people, it's kind of faded from their memories. What was it like for you to be part of this movement and to be documenting it?
Well, I think that Standing Rock is was an event that really gave impetus for a new generation of American Indians to be involved. Many of us who grew up in the 70s, remember Wounded Knee when the American Indian Movement took over that hamlet out in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. But Standing Rock really provided a means for contemporary Native kids and young adults to really participate in the movement.
And what was the atmosphere like, Levi? Because I think for people like myself who weren't there and watching news reports, I think we always get a limited snapshot of what happened.
Electrifying is actually the word that came to my mind as you asked that question. It was very electrifying for me. I'm a Potawatomi Native person. I live in Michigan, and I publish and edit Native News Online. However, as a reporter and as an American Indian, I was very, very proud of what what fellow tribal people were doing from across Indian country.
And I wonder, as a journalist, how you were able to navigate that. Obviously, you're familiar with having to build trust in the people that you talk to. And with a project that was so intimate, I wonder how you cultivated those relationships in what was sometimes a tense situation.
Well, I think, I was on the front line, so to speak. We had gone to this bridge that was closed down. And I remember in particular one day there was fellow journalists from the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, other places that were there. And some of the people who were kind of monitoring what the journalists were up to, I guess maybe part of the security detail out there, they saw my name badge with the logo. And clearly they recognized Native News Online. And some cases, one case, for instance, they said, come along with me. And they allowed me to get a little closer to the action. So I think it was one of those things where it was very fulfilling for me as a journalist, because I was proud to be part of it and be able to really give my perspective on it. And I think that Native journalists tend to give a little bit of a perspective than the mainstream media, albeit many of the several of the journalists from mainstream media stopped me and actually asked me questions about it so they could understand the situation a little better. So I was proud to be part of that process as well.
Right. And I imagine there was a lot of, I don't know if cultural translation is the right word, but for, as you're talking about how electrifying it was, and when you're talking about how this was a movement that was really created, how were you able to capture that in the photographs that you chose? Because I imagine you probably took a lot of photographs while you were there, right?
Actually, I took and I had a library after Standing Rock was somewhat finished, although we would probably argue the movement continues, but I had like 1,600 photographs of
wow.
in my library for Native News Online. And what happened was I was able to team up with the Grand Valley State University here, and I'm on the Native American Advisory Board. And so the Office of Coochie Local History, I'm also on that board, they offered to give me an intern. In last summer, we actually went through the process of just narrowing them down to 100 photos. And what, as a result, the exhibition that's going to open tomorrow night is are actually 53 photographs. So it was a long process. And it's like, you know, where do you cut? Because there were really some really, I thought, some real vivid photos that were real compelling that kind of tell the story. And what we try to do with this exhibition is not simply just put the photographs up, but actually there's a narrative, which I will say as a journalist, what's the line? Well, journalists, we tell the first draft
of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what happened was by the time I wrote the narratives for the exhibition, it was maybe 6 to 9 months removed, depending on the situation. And I was able to be a little more reflective and give it a little different, how can I say, maybe updated some of this original stories, because as I was writing the narrative, I went back to the original stories that Native News Online published at the time, but then I had a different perspective. So it was really an interesting process for me as a journalist.
I'm speaking with Levi Rickert, and we're talking about a photography exhibition that's opening tomorrow. As Levi's saying, 53 photographs that he made of Standing Rock. It's called Photos of an Indigenous Movement at the American Indian Center. Levi, I tweeted out one of the pictures that you sent us ahead of time for me to look at, and it's this amazing image of all of the encampment, and you can just get a sense of the amount of people that were there. Is that one of your favorite photographs? Can you tell us a little bit more about the picture?
You know, I didn't see the one you said tweeted. Is it the one that has?
It's the one with the love. So it, yes.
Okay, I have to say it's one of my personal favorites because, quite frankly, the local media at the time was putting out stories in North Dakota that, you know, these American Indians were a bunch of agitators from outside of the state of North Dakota, albeit tribes from across the country participated, but they really tried to give the spin that a bunch of them were nothing more than militant criminals, mob people that just wanted to go in and create a lot of chaos. And what I saw when I was there was quite the opposite. It was a bunch of people, Native people, who came to really lend their support to a cause that's very important to all of us, Native and non-Natives, the environment. And the word love on that banner just really caught my attention. I think it's one of my favorite because I think the world needs a lot more love than hate. And these days we could use a lot of love.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with that, Levi. A big part of the collection of the photos, also to your point about non-Natives, there was a significant veteran presence, military veterans who were at Standing Rock. Why was highlighting that relationship so important to you?
Well, I think that, you know, from a historic perspective, American Indians have participated on a percentage basis at a higher level than non-Natives in the U.S. military. And the idea that non-Native veterans came to lend support was pretty, I think, pretty astounding. And there again, to dispel the myth that these were a bunch of just radical militant people out at Standing Rock is quite contrary to what I saw up there. The veterans coming together, and I remember one Saturday night there was this massive rally with the veterans, and it was quite remarkable to listen to people one after the other come up and say why they were there, lending the support, and here comes that word love, the love that was flowing in the room, just the idea that it was, whether you were American Indian or non-Native, there was a lot of love in the room, and the idea that the veterans came to support was pretty monumental as far as I'm concerned.
We're talking with Levi Rickert and the pictures that he made at Standing Rock. It's an exhibition that's actually opening tomorrow at the American Indian Center in Chicago. And we've got Dave Spencer with the American Indian Center on the line with us as well. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you can tell us how Levi's work fits in with the mission of the work that you all are doing at the American Indian Center.
Yeah, it's pretty organic. Well, at the Indian Center, our exhibition space is dedicated to Native First Voice. So we feel that our space is the only space in the city of Chicago that's 100% Native Voice. And when it comes to issues like Standing Rock and what Levi has accomplished, it fits in perfectly because, again, it's our perspective. It's our way to tell our story how we want. And this, and you know, you have the visual, but then it's also the text, and it's also Levi coming and presenting his experience, and that's really important to us to use this space to tell those intergenerational stories.
And Levi, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this next question I'm going to ask Dave as well. As I mentioned, this was a couple of years ago. The pipeline did get built. I wonder if that changes how you all look at the photographs or the reason why you wanted to have the exhibition, Dave?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where media outlets, you know, non-Native media outlets, you know, they get an opportunity to tell their impressions of what we're trying to accomplish. And one of the things that at least I've seen in the Native news outlets, especially Levi's, is that, you know, this isn't just a Native problem. It's a human problem. And I think that's what media kind of lacks in its presenting our issues to the masses, is that, you know, we're looking out for ourselves, sure, but also, you know, it's all about community. And that, when I say community, I'm not talking internal, I'm talking external, the larger community as well, because it's going to affect all of us. So I think with these stories and these exhibits, people get a chance to see how, you know, we want to protect the earth for the good of humanity.
Levi?
Well, I think that from the perspective of the community, I think it's so important that I'm really proud as the publisher editor of Native News Online to have it at the Chicago Indian Center. It's one of the oldest urban Indian agencies in the United States. So from that perspective, I'm really, really proud and excited to be there tomorrow night. I think the overall goal, I think, of the exhibition is really to provide space for American Indians to share their narrative, who we are, that we still exist, and that it helps to bring, I'm hoping that the exhibition helps to bring recognition there are current issues beyond the pipeline there at the Missouri River, at Standing Rock, but like in Michigan, the Straits of Mackinac, where the Enbridge Line 5 is outdated. It would be extremely catastrophic if the line bursts. So the fight continues, the struggles continue.
In Michigan.
We talk about climate change, the environment, and, you know, sometimes it appears now in Washington with talk of deregulation and lessening of some of the Obama administration's EPA standards. I really think it's critical that we keep it to the forefront, that people understand this is real, climate change is real. If we don't do something quickly, you know, it could really be catastrophic for us in 10 to 15 years, as the report came out last week. And as a Native person, we like to jokingly say we have always been the first environmentalists. I think the exhibition helps really establish that point.
Dave, if people are visiting Chicago and want to see this exhibit, can you remind us where you guys are located? Because you moved recently.
We did. We moved from Ravenswood Community to the Albany Park. So we're at the corner of Kimball and Ainslie, and our direct address is 3401 West Ainslie. And if you're familiar with the Chicago Transit, just take the Brown Line to Kimball, and we're one block north.
Right. So the northwest part of the city.
Yes.
Okay, great. That is the Exhibition is called Standing Rock, Photos of an Indigenous Movement. As Levi and Dave have been telling us, it opens tomorrow. They're on display until November 9th. We will tweet out all of the information for the exhibit, as well as some of the photos. I want to thank Levi Rickert, who's also the publisher and editor, as he's been sharing with us, of Native News Online, as well as Dave Spencer, the development and arts coordinator for the American Indian Center. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A reminder, tonight at 7, I'll be hosting a debate between the candidates for the 13th Congressional District. That's Representative Rodney Davis and his Democratic challenger, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. Again, that's at 7 o'clock tonight. You can stream that live at 21stshow.org. We'll also be having it on Facebook, so you can do a live Facebook stream as well. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a good resource for how to contact us. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Jason Croft and Steve Moore provide technical direction and engineering. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.